Going Linux, episode 101, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux.
Currently, we are creating 3 episodes a month. We release listener feedback episodes at the beginning of each month and user experience episodes near the end.
And then, following the third Tuesday of each month, we post Larry's appearances on the live Computer America show, minus the commercials.
In the user experience episodes, we take 2 months to cover a topic. First, an introduction, then an in-depth look at the Linux operating system and its applications.
And in today's episode, we're doing listener feedback. We hope that you'll find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
Well, welcome out to the Barbie Ranch. This is my friend Rusty.
Howdy there!
And I'm Parnell. We wanted to congratulate you boys on your 100th podcast thing there. It's pretty impressive, and we've always thought you boys did a real professional kind of job on it, and we appreciate it being free and all.
It'd be a lot more useful if we had a computer out here, but you know.
Well, you know, we just can't plug one in, so we're just trying to make do with what we got here, so congratulations. Oh, and Rusty here had a question for you.
Yeah, we was just wondering, you was talking about doing backups a while back, and you told us how to do it using something called a Clonezilla and a couple other things. Sound like a good idea.
It sounded like a dandy idea all the time, but then you guys were saying that you had some problem with some Alpha software. We think it was Alpha.
Yeah, and that Skype thing there, you had some problems with it.
Yeah, it had you guys kind of chasing your tail to get it working. You did a good job and all, don't get me wrong, but it was just wondering, well, Rusty was wondering.
I was just wondering why you didn't just do a restore from your backup that you'd done, and then you'd be back to where you was at. It would have been no bother at all.
Well, you know, not that we know anything about this sort of thing, but, well, if you get a moment or two, I'd like to answer that. We'd appreciate it just for, you know, learning about this stuff. And, hey, if you're ever up by the Barbie Ranch, we'll keep a sheep tied up for you.
Well, Larry, Ubuntu 10.04 is finally out.
Yes.
What do you think of it so far?
I don't know. I haven't installed it yet.
Well, neither have I, because it's not really out yet at the time of this recording. It will be in a few days.
That's right. And so we'll just wait a little bit, and maybe on our next episode we'll have a few things to say. But in the meantime, I do have a question for our listeners. In our episode 100, we mentioned that we would be providing DVDs for sale on our website, and I haven't got them up there yet because I'm thinking of remastering the ISO images. And what I mean by that is, I'm kind of wondering, based on a comment that you made, Tom, that maybe instead of providing MP3 and WAV files on a DVD and AUG and WAV files on another version of the DVD, in order to keep the disk size down or the image size down, I was thinking, if people aren't really concerned about the high quality WAV files, I could probably fit the AUGs or the MP3s on a CD image rather than a DVD image.
Oh, there you go.
Most modern computers, if they have a CD or DVD burning drive, it's capable of doing both these days, but some of the older computers have only CD burning capability.
Right, and I think a lot of the people that we're talking to are running Linux because they have older computers.
Right, or are still on Windows and aren't able to mount an ISO image without actually burning it to a CD first. So let's toss it over to the listeners and ask, do you have a preference? Would you rather have the high-quality WAV files along with the standard MP3 or the AUG files that we send out? Or do you not care about that and you just prefer a smaller disk that you can burn to a less expensive CD and you are content with just the MP3s or the AUGs, let us know.
And as long as we're asking listeners for advice, I've got a new pet peeve. I love Skype. I've been using Skype for a long time. And now suddenly, I don't know how, but all kinds of weirdos and spammers have found my Skype address.
Mm-hmm.
So I get these things that want me to run out and invest in a particular stock or meet girls or make parts of my body larger or smaller or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's irritating. Now, I need some evil minions to come up with an idea for me. What I'm thinking is when those things come through, I want to send them a file. And I want the file, the name of the file, to be so alluring that they will accept it and open it, and something really bad will happen.
Tom, I think that makes you a virus writer.
No, maybe not a virus.
Okay.
Maybe, I don't know. A huge text file that just says, screw you, over and over.
Kind of the equivalent of sending, you know, when we had fax machines and we would get spam faxes,
mm-hmm.
Sending a completely black page to the other end of the spammer that eats up all their ink on their fax machine.
Right.
Or their
right.
toner. That is kind of the equivalent of that you're looking for.
And another one that I had fun with back in the day was to send a back when fax machines didn't just scan a non-moving piece of paper, the paper would actually move through the machine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you make an endless loop...
it just keeps going and going and going.
Page after page. Well, anyway, that's off subject. Somebody think of a way for me to strike out at these guys and make them sorry that they're spamming me.
Yeah, or if you have already... developed one. That would be cool.
Right.
You know, the most amusing Skype spam message that I've been getting is the one that tells me that my Linux computer is affected with a Windows virus and that my computer is infected and that I really must immediately download this program to be able to fix the Windows viruses that have infected my Linux computer.
Yeah. And really, the when you look at the damage that something can do, the cost is pretty reasonable.
Of course, we're joking, folks.
Right. Your Linux machine cannot get a Windows virus.
Right. And if you are a Windows user and you do get a message by Skype that says that your computer has been scanned, that you do have a virus and that you must immediately download a program, don't do it.
Right.
Have somebody on Skype scan your computer. Just doesn't happen.
Same thing with if you're just browsing the internet and suddenly a pop-up window says, hey, you've got this horrible virus.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's nonsense.
Don't click. Do not click. So, shall we get on to our listener feedback, Tom?
Yeah, I think our minion section is pretty much done now.
We got a new section, minion section.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, our first feedback is an audio feedback from Russ Woodman, and he provided us this audio feedback.
Hey, Tom and Larry, this is Russ from the Linux in the Ham Shack podcast. Now, just got done listening to your listener feedback episode, number 98. Since we are about as narcissistic as anyone on the planet, and sure enough, if Linux in the Ham Shack had come out before Narcissus had been born, then narcissism would be called Linux in the Ham Shackism. But thank you for mentioning our show. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Zaster, which you mentioned on your program. We had the same email from David in the UK, who told you his Going Linux story. And you mentioned Zaster, and were wondering what Zaster was, and hoped that we over at Linux in the Ham Shack might know. And the fact of the matter is, we do know. Zaster is what's called an APRS program. It's a client for the Automatic Packet Reporting System, which is a GPS and ham radio based system for tracking assets. It allows you to keep track of vehicles, keep track of items, using a global database and the internet, and amateur radio technology, and Zaster puts everything together. It does the mapping, it shows you APRS-connected devices, so you can do your tracking. It also has messaging capabilities. So, for anyone who might be interested in doing some work with amateur radio and Linux, they could definitely take a look at Zaster.
Especially people who are interested in that kind of technology, GPS, mapping, cartography, asset tracking, mobility, and so on. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that you had someone write in with an older DSL modem. Now, I have seen several of those. Most of the ones that I've seen have been hybrid devices, where they have an RJ45 connector for Ethernet and a USB connection. Believe it or not, there are some people who own computers that do not have Ethernet devices or Ethernet cards in them. And for those people, USB connectivity via a USB network adapter in their DSL modem works rather well. However, we've never seen anyone who had an operating system newer than about Windows ME or Windows 98 Second Edition who needed such a device. And the problem with most of those devices is that if you have to actually use the USB interface, the networking chipsets on them are proprietary, and the only drivers that are written for them are for Windows. I'm not sure any of the ones I've seen were even Mac OS compatible. So the chances of them working with Linux is very small. There are some USB Ethernet devices that are compatible with Linux, and it may be a case of a small kernel tweak would get such devices working, but it would be much easier to go out and buy a cheap Ethernet-based DSL modem to get it working that way. And as we all know, if your computer doesn't have an Ethernet card in it, but does happen to have a PCI slot, PCI-based wired Ethernet cards are very cheap these days. So anyway, that's about all the information I have. I just thought I would get this information down in iPadio while I had my iPhone handy and while I was on the road and while this episode was fresh in my mind. So thank you for mentioning us once again. We will make sure to talk about our good friends over at Going Linux the next time we record a show, which will be in a couple of weeks. Keep up the good work over there. I enjoy listening to your show every time it comes out. I can't say I'm a big fan of the live radio program, but that's just a personal preference. The stuff you guys put out is always interesting, and while I've been using Unix and Linux for over 20 years now, every once in a while I still get a nugget of information I can use. So thanks very much. Talk to you all later. Have a great couple of weeks.
Well, Russ, thanks very much for that excellent comment, and we're glad to mention your show, and if you mention ours, that's great too.
And thanks also for defining Zaster for us. That helps a lot. We had no idea what it was, and we knew you would, so thank you.
Oh, yeah, and about that older DSL modem, I think you're right. Put it in the bin, recycle it, and move along, get something a little more. It's not expensive.
Right. Well, our next email is from Danny, who wrote, "Hello.
Hello, Danny.
My name is Danny. I use a Mac, a Windows machine, and now I plan to get into Linux. I have used Ubuntu's Live CD, but the one that will be installed to a box I will get is Debian. The reason for this is because Debian does not install Pulse Audio, which is not good for me as a user of Orca, a screen reader. I use Orca because I am totally blind. What is the best way for me to give you my observations about installing Linux with Orca? This, I know, might not be of interest to many, but I want to allow Linux users to know about accessibility. This is important because Orca is not supported by any company, but is all done by individuals. Please write me if you want me to clear anything up for you. Danny." Well, thanks, Danny. And the best way to give us feedback is to send us an email or record some audio and send it to us by email. We'd be happy to read your email or play your audio comment on the show. And if you have any comments for us regarding accessibility under Linux and Orca in particular, please feel free just to send them out to us unsolicited. We'd be happy to share those.
Right. And I did email Danny back. And I don't have any experience with Orca. Larry, you don't either, I don't think.
No, I've tried it out a little bit, but as a sighted person, I don't find a lot of value in it, except maybe to read some documents to me while I'm doing something else. But hey.
Did you get it to talk?
Yeah, I actually did. This was a couple of years ago on an older version of Linux, but yeah, it worked just fine for me.
You know what? Now that I think about it, I did too. And what I experienced was it started reading the screen really, really fast and annoying. I just, well, shut up. But Danny, as you go through the process of installing it and perfecting it, please, 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 yes, we do want your feedback on that for other people who might be sight impaired too.
Mm-hmm. And Danny actually wrote back to us. He has received his ham radio license. He may be communicating with the Linux in the Ham Shack folks as well. And he said, hello, Larry and Tom. Hello, Danny.
Hello, again. Danny.
Just got my call sign. It's KJ4UHI. I have no radio yet, but hope to have one soon. Danny. Well, good luck
cool,
with that,
Danny. You're going to like that. So, okay, next up we've got Darman, who provided us this iTunes alternative. Darman said, hello, Larry and Tom. Hello, Darman.
Hello, Darman.
I listen to the Going Linux podcast regularly, and I have found it very useful, as I also have Unix as a subject in my final semester of Bachelor's in Computer Engineering. I have kept on trying out the new distros of Ubuntu since its 8.04 release. I just wanted an application that can be used in Linux to sync my iPod with my music library, and also to automatically download podcasts just like iTunes does in Windows. Are there such applications available for Linux?
Yeah, well, Darman, we have a number of resources for you here. We have covered this in previous shows, and there are things like Rhythmbox, of course, and Songbird, and Amarok. And many of these also double as podcast subscribing software or podcast playing software. So if you would like to read our article and follow our links to how to subscribe to a podcast, as well as how to manage your music using some of these software programs under Linux, you could go to subscribe.goinglinux.com. And in that article on subscribing, you'll find links to managing your music using some of these programs.
And Larry, you mentioned Songbird. Not so much in the news lately. Songbird is dropping their support of Linux.
What?
So, a moment of silence. Okay, so the Songbird solution is probably off the table for you. I never liked the darn thing anyway.
Well, yeah, and I had heard, now that you mention it, that they were dropping support for Linux and focusing only on Windows. That's sad.
Yeah.
But, hey, I'm sure they have their reasons. Haven't got a clue what they would be, but there you go. All right. And our next email is from John, who commented a few comments about episode 98. This was the first episode that I have listened to. As I try to convert more folks to Linux, hearing the issues from new users will help me better understand those issues. I appreciate the work you guys do sharing the goodness of Linux. Printing the screen in Windows. I'm fairly certain that all versions of Microsoft Windows support capturing the screen with Alt Print Screen for an application window and Control Print Screen for the entire desktop. It has worked this way since Windows 95, and I've used it many, many times in Vista Home. RDIF backup. I didn't catch all the details, but I did hear someone say that you had to dedicate an entire USB drive to RDIF backup. Not true. If the user has a file system on the USB drive, any subdirectory can work. You want to be certain that the same subdirectory is always used, so you get librsync diffs.
That's, okay, librsync diffs. That would be the rsync library, and diffs means new files or changes to old files. And diffs are smaller files that record just the changes, I believe.
Okay. We'll go with that.
Okay.
He continues, I've been using RDIF backup for company server backups and to back up my Linux home for years. Here's a link to my blog, which explains how, and we'll include that link in the show notes. It includes the script that I use and is full-featured enough for most users. Of course, there are many ways to accomplish a task in Linux, and mine is just one way. Differential backups are so important that rsync just doesn't do it for me anymore. RDIF backup has the mirror directory image, plus some number of older versions. I keep 30 days on servers and 90 days of my home. Of course, when there's a, quote, cockpit error, it's the mirror from last night that I restore from almost always. Keep up the good work, Jay.
Yeah, and you know, Jay, that sounded to me, when the other user said you have to dedicate a drive to it, that doesn't seem right to me either, so thank you.
Yeah.
And then next up, we've got Roger. And Roger says, Bonjour, Larry and Tom. Bonjour,
Roger.
Heard you talking about problems encountered using a webcam with Skype under Linux in the last listener feedback episode 98. I have an older Logitech eyeball webcam and also struggled to get it working with Skype Beta 2.1.0.47. Ooh, he's an early adopter. Mm-hmm. Under Ubuntu Karmic. LSUSB identified the webcam thus. And now what he's saying is he went to a terminal and typed LSUSB. And that tells you everything about every USB device attached to your machine. Mm-hmm. Bus 2, device 2, ID, blah, blah, Logitech Inc. QuickCam Express / Go. A bit of research on the Ubuntu Wiki revealed that preloading a video for Linux, V4L, compatibility library would help. Launching Skype like this, with Alt F2, and what Alt F2 is bring up a command window, where you can type just one command if you like.
Right, right.
And then you type, and we'd better put this in the show notes because it'll be hard to follow.
It's pretty long.
Yeah. But instead of just launching Skype by typing Skype in a terminal or clicking on the icon, he's using this to launch Skype, and it brings Skype up with a fully functional webcam. Hope this helps the listener with the problem. Love the podcast. Started listening at episode 1 when I had my second coming with Linux using Ubuntu Edgy. First time around about 1999 with an old version of Mandrake, things were much more difficult and you guys were not around to help. Keep up the good work. Cheers from a Linux-loving Brit living in Belgium. Roger. And Roger,
well, thanks, Roger.
Thank you very much. And Belgium, as a matter of fact, is where my people came from. So I would love to visit there one day.
Yes. And just a comment on that Alt F2 and the command. We'll, of course, include the command in the show notes. But if any of our listeners find that this fixes their problem with their webcam, and I recall somebody in Alaska had contacted me with a problem with a webcam. Maybe this is the fix to the problem. But anyway, what you can do with this, if it works using Alt F2, you can change the launcher. That's the menu selection for Skype, so that instead of starting Skype the normal way, it uses this command, which actually preloads that library that that Roger was talking about. So the way you would do that is to right-click on the Applications menu in the GNOME desktop and select Edit Menus. Find where the Skype menu is selected, and generally that's under Internet. Select Skype on the right-hand side of the windows that's listed Items, and click Properties. That will show you the command that is launched, and normally it's just plain Skype. And if this Alt-F2 solution works for you preloading that library, you can just substitute the command that we'll have in the show notes, the one that you would normally have run using the Alt-F2 keystrokes. Just replace the command Skype with that command.
Right, so basically you can automate this thing. You don't have to type it out every time. You can have Nautilus, I guess, type it out for you.
Right, just edit the launcher in the menus.
Right.
There you go. Alexei wrote us from Moscow, Russia. Hi there, Larry and Tom.
Hi there, Alexei.
Hi there, Alexei. I hope you don't have any nasty filter in your mailbox for letters with the word Windows in the subject line and a little smiley face. To be serious, I've just listened to your episode 98, and there are two moments I'd like to give you some feedback on. Firstly, Larry, you were talking about your experience with Skype and your friend's webcam. I had similar experience myself with a webcam bundled with my graphics card. It worked flawlessly with Cheese, but not at all with Skype. I did some search on the topic, and here's what I came up with. It's definitely a Skype issue, and it affects a wide variety of webcams. I don't remember very well all the technical details I've read, but it seems that Skype wants video from the webcam to come in some particular format, and not all the webcams can supply it. One of the most helpful pages on the topic I have found is this, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes, but it's wiki.ubuntu.com/skypewebcams.
All one word, Skype webcams.
Right. You can find a list of webcams there divided into categories. Just works, works with some fiddling, and doesn't work at all, as well as some steps suggested to get it working, or links to additional info on the topic. There is a great possibility you've already been there, but if by any chance not, do it. It's a good starting point, I think. Secondly, for Tom, concerning screenshots in Windows, kind of legal statement, don't know the right words for the likes of it. One, I don't mean to defend Windows, I just tell it as it is so you can help people out even if they, poor things, still do use Windows. Two, my information applies mainly to Windows XP. I'm not sure I tried it on Vista, and for sure didn't on Windows 7. But still, it's been like this from the times of Windows 95 and 98, and it's worth trying. Indeed, when you press print screen, Windows shows no reaction at all, but the fact is that it does take a screenshot, and behold, it stores it in the clipboard buffer. So, to actually see or use your screenshot, you open any graphical editor. MS Paint will do, or Photoshop. It also works with MS Word as well. Then create a new empty document there, and after that, paste your screenshot from the clipboard. Then you can save your file and do whatever you like with it. Very straightforward, clear, and easy to understand behavior, isn't it? Especially for inexperienced users. Don't say I'm too sarcastic here. Sometimes it's useful to guide someone in need of help through that and then send you the results. Well, it's my 5 cents worth piece of information for you guys. Thank you for what you're doing. I like your podcast, especially thank you for your clear English you're speaking. It's really important for non-native listeners such as me. Look forward to hearing from you more. Alexei.
Thanks, Alexei.
Thanks.
And I need to say here that, recapping, my sister was on a Windows machine. We were Skyping each other. She didn't know what she was looking at, and I said, well, take a screenshot. How do you do that? Well, find the print screen button and push that, and nothing happened. I said, well, try Alt print screen, and nothing happened. And I said, all right, what version of Windows are you using? Vista Home Edition. I went out on Google. I Googled print screen Windows Vista. And the page it took me to first said, not included, sorry, can't do it on the home edition. So maybe there is a way that I didn't see. Maybe that page was wrong. Maybe there's some confusion here. I don't know.
Yeah, and I talked to Carrie on the Computer America show, and he says that it's possible even on Vista Home. So
okay.
I don't know.
I just wasn't finding it.
Yeah.
And Larry, you wrote back a response to Alexi. You said, hello, Alexi. Thanks so much for the information and for the link. I really appreciate it. I'll be looking at that compatibility list with great interest. Thanks also for the tip on screenshots. I think the behavior you describe has been removed in Vista and Windows 7. Another listener informed us that there is a new snipping tool that replaces the clipboard. I remember that they had the snipping tool in a Windows XP tablet computer that I used to have at work. Not as convenient, but at least it works. Larry.
And Alexi wrote as a follow-up, hi, Larry. Hi, Alexi, and thank you for your reply, and such a quick one. I hope your experience with webcam and Skype will be a successful one. I wish I could help you more with it. I spent quite an amount of time trying to get my old webcam working with Skype and gave a try to most of the advice, workarounds, and tricks I have found, but no success. Still, I believe my webcam is way older than the one you were speaking about. It was kind of no-name, bundled with Asus graphic card, but I think it was made by someone for Asus, and I found out that just the same ones were often bundled with other products from other manufacturers as well. And even if it worked, its quality was not very good, so I haven't got many to fight for. So I wasn't disappointed with my failure and just bought the cam that should have worked with Linux in general and Linux version of Skype in particular. And indeed, it did just that. It's one of the newer models of Logitech, and when choosing, I used for reference that very list I gave you the link to. I think that as your friends, one is Logitech and not no name, and it's almost for sure not very old, you have a pretty fair chance of getting it working. If I can help you in any way, some more research on the topic, discuss it in some way or other, feel free to contact me. I can try to search some model-specific information if you give me the exact model of that webcam. As for screenshots in Windows, I beg your pardon if I'm too pedantic here, but it does seem to me that the behavior I wrote about wasn't removed from either Vista or Windows 7. Instead, snipping tool you told us about was added as a more easy and clear solution for the same task. Again, I can't confirm that from my own first-hand experience, as I no longer use Vista and have never used Windows 7. Alas, I still have to use Windows XP on my work computer to run some terrible Russian accounting program, but 99% of the time, I do that in VirtualBox from Fedora. Well, you guys can say that I've gone Linux quite successfully. Still, I did a little research on the internet after reading your email, and the results seem to confirm my opinion. Print screen still behaves on Vista and Windows 7 the way it did on XP and earlier. And besides it, there is this snipping tool. As you've said in the show, it's not included in some cheaper versions of Vista. But then again, snipping tool is a sort of additional screenshot taking program, and you have to run it prior to making the screenshot. And here's one more point I've encountered about print screen versus snipping tool from a user named Antman on the 7forums.com, and we'll include a link to that. And now the quote from Antman. I still use this old school trick to capture transient screen images like tooltips. The snipping tool will take system focus and some dialog boxes will disappear. Print screen slash paste is a very good thing to know and remember. And Alexi continues. And one final blow to snipping tool and all the windows with it. If I, being a quite experienced user myself, were looking for a screenshot taking utility in Windows, scanning through menu and such, I would never guess that something called snipping tool has something to do with screenshots. That's it again about clearness and ease of use and all such things. Well, maybe I'm not right making so much fuss about such a small issue, and even more so about some Windows issues. I think I just like your show and was glad to have some opportunity to contribute something. I hope you can tolerate me with my long letters. Thank you again for your attention and for your great work out there, Alexi.
And thanks, Alexi, for all of that. And long letters, around here we call that content. So, and I'm starting to think now that maybe I should set up a Windows machine just so I can do research into what doesn't work.
Okay, well, put your rubber gloves on, wear the mask, goggles, take all safety precautions.
Yeah, and do not connect it to the internet.
Exactly.
Okay, next up, Doug provided us this brief note. Hi, Larry and Tom.
Hi, Doug.
I believe you can install Windows as the primary operating system, boot to Linux, point VirtualBox to the Windows install, and run it that way. No need to reboot to use Windows. Doug. And he says, sent from my iPhone. Okay, good point, Doug. I can't verify that. I don't have a copy of Windows, but that sounds very reasonable. It sounds like it should work.
Yeah, and I think I've seen some instructions on how to do that. I don't recall where I've seen them, or we would include the link in the show notes, but sure. We don't have a link. And if somebody does know of where to find the instructions on how to take a VirtualBox running in Linux and point it to your actual physical hardware install of Windows so that when you launch VirtualBox, it runs that, that would be cool.
Sure.
Our next email is from Srivani. And Srivani asked us how to do some programming. Good evening, sir. This is Srivani. Good evening, Srivani.
Good evening, Srivani.
Such a formal way to introduce your email. And Srivani continues, I am in my final year of B-Tech. I am doing a project under the Linux environment. Part of my project includes a shell script that does the task of compiling a user program. The compilation part is done by my code, but I want to create a new command that compiles the user program just as the cc command does. I have browsed the net, posing the question how to create new Linux command, but could not get it done. Can you please suggest to me how I might create a new command under Linux? Thank you, Srivani.
Okay, Larry and I differ on our understanding of the question just a little bit, but look into environmental variables in a shell script, such as $1, $2, so that you can incorporate from the same line that you executed the shell script different variables, such as file names.
Right. That's a good way of incorporating user input into your shell script. And if what you're asking, Srivani, is how do you create a program that is a Linux command, which was my interpretation of your question, you would do that the same way you would create any program. So you write your program, whatever you want it to do in C, C++, whatever language you're using, except that you're not creating a graphical program, you're creating a command line program. Use something like GCC to compile that, and then you've got a command that runs and does what you told it to do in your programming under C or C++ or whatever language you want to use. Simple as that.
Yeah, that's about the best we can do for you, just off the hip.
Yeah.
And next up, we hear from Gregory, who wrote, Hello, Larry and Tom.
Hello, Gregory.
Recently, I've become a listener of your Going Linux podcast. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the nice work you're doing. Keep it up. I'd also like to contribute a couple ideas about the new episodes. Since the latest versions of GNOME and KDE are not so easy on system resources, I think it would be nice if you made an episode, or even a couple of them, covering lightweight desktop environments like XFCE or LXDE, or even about creating your own desktop environment from scratch. Installing X11, a Windows manager like OpenBox, panels, system trays, choosing a file manager, stuff like that. It would also be cool to hear you tell about the do-it-yourself style distros aimed at the more advanced audience, like Arch, Gentoo, or Slackware. I shudder every time I hear the word Slackware. Hope you'll find these suggestions interesting. Take care, Grigory. Thank you, Grigory. Those are a little more advanced, but something definitely to think about. And by the way, Slackware people, I was not putting down Slackware. I just have a short attention span, and I'm sure it's a wonderful distribution, but I haven't been able to wrap my head around it yet.
Yes, and Grigory, you might want to go back and listen to episode 59 of our podcast. That's where we were talking about podcasting with Linux and gave an introduction. At that point, Tom, you had just switched from GNOME to XFCE and were trying that out. And we had a little bit of a discussion there.
Mm-hmm.
And in that same episode, we had talked about LXDE as well. So go back, listen to that one. Hopefully that gives you a little bit of information about LXDE, at least Tom's comments on it. And if I like your idea of talking about the desktop environments in general, and maybe an episode on lightweight distributions would be good.
Yeah, maybe we should revisit that. By the way, yeah. LXDE is lightning fast.
Yes.
I remember when I did that, the first time I booted it up, there was something on my screen real early, and I thought, well, what the heck is this? Oh, it's done. This is it. It's ready to go.
Yeah. Very good. All right.
That's it for the emails.
That's it for our emails. No Gone Linux emails, but hey, we'll have them next time, I'm sure.
Well, Alexi sort of was a Gone Linux. Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah, sort of. Yeah. We'll count that one. Okay.
And we did have an audio feedback this month. Thank you. And we very much encourage that because it allows us to sit back, enjoy our coffee, and have content on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, we can relax while doing our work.
Right.
Okay. Do you have a software pick, Tom?
My software pick is a strange one. It's not free. It's not open source. It's not any of the above. But what it is RealPlayer. If you're running Linux and you miss RealPlayer, or in my case, I found an audio stream that I couldn't find a good way to play easily in Linux, and RealPlayer is available, at least for Ubuntu. And to install that, type sudo alt-get RealPlayer, all one word, and bada bing, you've got it.
All right.
And it works just like the old RealPlayer did in the other distributions.
So if you've got a fix for nostalgia.
That's it. Yeah, it's a nostalgia pick.
It's a nostalgia pick. There you go. Well, mine isn't really a software pick. It involves software, but it involves hardware as well. And the software is any Linux distribution that you can install using a live CD. And the hardware part of it is a USB drive. As we all know, the Linux live CDs allow you to install a Linux distribution onto your computer's hard drive and allows you to take that 650, 700 megabyte CD and install a whole Linux distribution onto your hard drive. Well, you also may be aware that there is a program called UnetBootin that allows you to take the live CD and put it on a USB stick and run it as a live USB. Well, what I have done is taken a live CD, in this case of Linux Mint, and you could probably do this with as small as a 1 gigabyte USB stick or thumb drive. But I would really recommend doing this with something bigger, like 2 or more. And I've taken a, what size is this? 16 gigabyte thumb drive. And the reason you want it bigger is so that you have room for data. And I have inserted the blank USB thumb drive and a live CD. And I have booted from the live CD and installed Linux Mint 8 onto my USB thumb drive as though it were a hard drive. And what I have found is that I have my entire Linux computer on a thumb drive that I can carry around in my pocket.
And it's persistent. So you can install applications on there, and they'll be there the next time you boot it up.
Exactly. And the nice thing about Linux is I can plug this into any hardware. It will find the hardware, install whatever drivers it needs to install, and I'm up and running. I have moved it from a Lenovo computer to an HP computer to an Asus netbook computer and even a tablet computer, and they've all worked just perfectly using this Linux Mint installation. And for those people who have been using Linux for a long time, this is not a big revelation that you can do this, but it's something that I have only recently tried to do. And the nice thing is that I can use this as my portable Linux computer and have it available wherever someone has hardware, and I can use it with all my settings, exactly my data, all my shortcuts and bookmarks, and all of the things that I have installed on there, and any data that I can squeeze into that last remaining bit of the 16 gigabytes that's on the thumb drive.
Kind of like having a computer in your pocket.
That's exactly what it is. And if I could afford to buy a 32 gigabyte thumb drive or bigger, you know, the days are not that long ago that 32 gigabytes was about the size of a hard drive in a laptop.
Right, right. Getting exactly. Smaller, getting cheaper all the time.
Yep, you bet.
Now, not all thumb drives are created equal. I have tried to install Linux on my 8 gigabyte and failed miserably. It just wouldn't work. However, I've got an old 50 megabyte that I can put DSL on, damn small Linux, and it'll boot perfectly. So there's something about different USB drives. Some you can do it with, some you can't. I don't know what the difference is, and I don't know how to tell before you buy it.
Yeah, I also was unable to even install a live CD on one USB stick that worked just fine under Windows and wouldn't work under Linux for some reason. I remember that now that you mention it. You're absolutely right. And the thumb drives that I've been using that seem to be completely compatible, I have one from HP, that's the 16 gigabyte. I have a couple of 2 gigabyte ones from, I can't tell where they're from because it's erased off of them. Okay, well, bottom line is you have to be careful which one you buy.
And there's no way to be careful because you won't know until you buy it.
Yep. So buy it from a place that has a generous return policy.
Right, there you go.
Okay. Well, that's it for our episode for today, Tom.
Okay.
Our next episode is a Computer America episode. Until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information, detailed instructions, screencasts, and illustrations.
In the meantime, please email us with comments, questions, and suggestions. And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the Podcast Alley button to leave your topic suggestion while you vote for us on their site.
You can also send us an audio comment by email. We'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com.
And today's audio comment was provided by Russ Woodman from the Linux and the Ham Shack podcast. And thank you, Russ. We appreciate it.
Yes.
And you can follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. We are Going Linux, all one word. You can download the episodes from the website, or you can use the Flash Player to play them right on the show notes page.
You can also get future episodes delivered directly to your computer automatically as soon as new episodes are available. For instructions on how to subscribe to a podcast, go to subscribe.goinglinux.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.